Hey guys, if you want updates on our latest episodes, then be sure to subscribe to the Film Colossus podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Also, if you'd like to support the show and hear episodes ad-free, then subscribe to our Patreon page at patreon.com/filmcolossus.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
My name's Travis Bean.
My name's Chris Lambert.
Welcome to Film Colossus,
your guide to movies.
You, the one with that smile, yeah. Come over here for a while. Hey, girl, do you hear what I say?
And we truly are the guides, or I guess maybe Chris is the guide to this movie. Are you not?
Yeah, this is a movie I have spent many an hour writing about, and a lot of I guess you don't use ink anymore, but if I was using ink,
you would have gone through a few quills.
Yeah. I would have burned out some quill. I would have been writing so fast and furiously that the quill would have caught on fire. Ink would have caught on fire. The page would have caught on fire.
They would have to, like, next day deliver some feathers for you.
Yeah. I'd have to run out, catch a peacock.
You think peacocks are what they use for quills?
Weren't they? I mean, not all the time, I guess. But, like, aren't there the fancy, like, peacock quills that people sometimes... I always picture Benjamin Franklin writing with, like, a peacock quill.
I have to be honest. I've never once in my entire life thought about what bird was used for a quill. So, like, I'm sitting here genuinely asking you, like, was it a peacock?
I don't know. Guess that's another podcast.
Yeah, our listeners will update us on that. But today we are talking about... I remember back in 2013 when this movie came out. It was like everyone was talking about it, the feel-good movie of the year, Prisoners. Like, it's got all your favorite actors in there, and like they're all holding hands and smiling the entire time. I was so excited to see it.
It's just a happy, it's one of those rare movies that doesn't even have a nadir. It's just happy from start to finish.
Yeah. No, just kidding. This is an awful, awful movie to watch. It'll make you feel terribly sad and have no hope for the world. So this will be a fun episode.
So that's your reaction. My reaction is just like pure joy as I watch this movie.
Well, I just meant thematically. That's kind of what it's getting at. I'm not hinting at how I felt watching the movie. We'll get into that later.
We'll get into that. Yeah, Prisoners is one. It's been big for Film Colossus over the years. I think I wrote the guide on it in 2019. And it took like a few months of like... kind of like digging into the movie, watching, rewatching, like piecing it together. There's so much nuance in this film. And then when I finally like wrote our, what was at the time, like giant explanation on Prisoners, which is now like what, the colossal explanation or just like the movie guide.
Yeah.
It's just been something that like now hundreds of thousands of people have read over the years, which is pretty exciting. It's nice to kind of help people understand this movie, and it makes me happy that so many people continue to like watch this movie and be impressed by it. Like, spoiler alert, I think this is like an incredible, incredible movie, and should be one that's talked about for like decades, if not centuries.
So. Yeah, it seems Denis Villeneuve.
Villeneuve.
He seems to have that effect on people, like his movies. Like, a lot of people are obsessed with Arrival and Blade Runner 2049, and obviously Dune. But Prisoners, it's an interesting one because like all three of those movies are sci-fi, and this is like, it's not a Midwestern movie. It felt Midwestern to me the whole time. It's like a Pennsylvania. They're in Pennsylvania. But it has such a humble aura. Like, it's so downtrodden and like normal, ordinary folk and going through something extraordinary, but still it's, there's something very real about it that isn't like a lot of his big movies. Like Polytechnique's like that. It's about a shooting. And I guess Sicario, to an extent, is at least like on the ground, like stuff that actually happens in this world. We're watching that happen. but Prisoners is like the most just like, it just feels the most familiar, I guess. Like it's something that like affects people, like something we hear about. They're going through all the themes and emotions people are going through. Like it's all stuff that's very relatable. So it's interesting to see that Prisoners, of all of his movies, seems to have like stood time the best so far. It came out on Netflix and we just had an influx of people searching what happened, what's going on in Prisoners. Like that many people are watching it, that many people are curious about it and talking about it online and searching it. It's just, it's crazy that Denis seems to continually do that to people.
It's a similar effect that Christopher Nolan has.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's funny how you're describing Prisoners as being like a little more like grounded, approachable is probably not the right word, but like familiar right. in a way relative to his other films. And I recently watched Insomnia for the first time, which, have you ever watched Insomnia?
I sure have.
I have never seen it. And it's like the only, it's now... What's the first one that he did? His first film's the only one that I've ever seen. Yeah, Following. So it was one of two that I'd never seen. And there was something like incredibly refreshing, like going back to early Christopher Nolan, where he's kind of felt a bit more restrained.
Right.
Like he was within the system rather than larger than the system or like in blockbuster mode. Compared to his other films, like there was something a lot more familiar, approachable, just simple and kind of beautiful about his filmmaking in Insomnia and how just the narrow scope of the story and the groundedness of the story really allowed that to shine. And Prisoners, I think, has a similar, I mean, I think Prisoners is like far and away 1,000 times a better movie, but I think there's a similar dynamic at play when you compare where Denis went to and where Nolan went to and how each of Insomnia and Prisoners kind of stand as this like last bastion of like smallness and normalcy.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's crazy. And so, okay, let's backtrack a little. Prisoners comes out in 2013. Did you see it back then?
I did not. I had, what was going on in 2013? I was in Iowa.
Oh gosh, we were both in Iowa.
We were both in Iowa. So I don't remember what was going on at the time that I would have missed it because we were definitely doing Film Colossus work.
Mm-hmm.
I was seeing movies in theaters. I don't know how I missed this when it came out. But it was something that wasn't even like, I kind of remember the trailers for it and just kind of having this like, okay, like Hugh Jackman's an interesting actor. Jake Gyllenhaal's like pretty good, but eh. And for some reason I was completely ambivalent to this movie, though. Mm-hmm. I remember the trailers being like very intense.
Yeah, I probably saw the trailer. But I honestly don't have much recollection of this movie back in 2013. I mean, it just, like we said, it's been evergreen. Like, it's remained popular. So, like, I just heard about it and then eventually watched it probably a few years after it came out.
Yeah, I think the first time I saw it was... So, I saw Sicario. I had never seen, like, a Villeneuve movie either at that point. So, I didn't know anything about him. I also remember Enemy, like the trailer for that, and being like, Jake Gyllenhaal is busy.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until Sicario that I discovered, in quotes, Villeneuve. Yeah. I was at the San Sebastian Film Festival, and I don't know what it was about the movie. I think it was like the premiere movie or something. And I just happened to get into it. And it was in this old theater in San Sebastian in like northern Spain, just like 10 miles from the border with Italy. Beautiful, beautiful, like coastal city that I've been wanting to go to for years. It had been kind of like a bucket list thing. So to go to a film festival there was really exciting. And I'm in this old school theater in like the balcony. So it's like a theater with the balcony seating on the side. So I'm sitting on the side and this movie comes on. I was just entranced start to finish with Sicario. Like blew my mind, was raving about it. The moment the movie ended, started telling everybody I could talk to that it was one of the best movies I've seen in like forever. So I was pretty obsessed with Denis after that. And I think it was when I got back that I realized he had done Prisoners. And I finally watched it in like 2015, 2016.
Got it. Yeah. Sicario definitely would have been my first Denis movie. I've only seen that once, which I think to you, both you and our mutual friend Jordan's dismay, you both seem to be big fans of that movie. So I've always wanted to rewatch it, even though I don't remember particularly loving it. And over the years, I don't know what order I watched them all in. I remember watching Arrival when it came out, so I probably watched that next, and then got around to Prisoners, probably like 2016, 2017. And, you know, I was much more of a fan of Arrival. I have also not revisited that movie. I kind of wonder if I would like it as much, but I remember at the time really enjoying it, as much as you can enjoy a depressing movie like that. I remember probably around then I watched Prisoners, and it's funny, I don't have much of a recollection of watching it the first time. I don't think I had a negative or positive reaction to it. Like I feel like I would remember it if I did. The second time I watched it is what I remember more, because I probably ended up watching it after I realized your article was blowing up, and I was like, all right, like, give this movie another shot. And really did not enjoy it the second time. I find your piece fascinating. Like, I like the labyrinthine style of the movie, and I do think there's a lot of thematic meat there, and there's a lot for the actress to chew on, but for whatever reason, the presentation of all those things wasn't hitting me. So that was my attitude coming into this viewing of the movie.
Okay, so this would be your third time watching
it. This was my third time, yeah.
Okay. I remember the first time I watched it, I think it's one of the like few films that I don't think I rewatched it immediately after, but I think I watched it again within like the first week of seeing it the first time, just being like, oh my God, like the intensity that I felt, like the how impressed I was, especially like Roger Deakins, just like the cinematography, like really hit for me. And I then watched it, I want to say like three more times while writing the article, while also like going back and forth through it. And then I did movie guide pieces for it recently, so watched it again, and then for the podcast watched it again. So I'm somewhere in like approaching the 10 watch range.
Yeah. Which is like, there aren't many movies in your life you've seen that many times.
No, which is kind of crazy to me that this one is, with how kind of like under the radar it was. But even rewatching it this time, like, just such joy.
Yeah, I love that about, like, this will sound really dumb and lame compared to like us talking about Prisoners, but like every time I watch Superbad, like I feel like I notice more things about it and like kind of realize the depth of it. And how much it goes beyond just like stupid high school comedy. It's just really fun to keep rewatching movies that much. And by the 10th time you watch something, you're like suddenly looking at like the people in the background and like noticing things that like probably don't matter, but like you want to read into everything, you know?
Yeah. There's that scene, in Prisoners where Hugh Jackman and, Terrence Howard have Alex, Paul Dano, and Hugh Jackman's like, I have the hammer, like, don't make me do it, are you gonna make me do it? And you're so caught up in like Alex and Hugh that this time I was just watching Terrence Howard's
face. That's funny. I was looking at Terrence Howard there.
Yeah, just him being like, oh, and him kind of leaning forward at one point to look at Alex's hand on the sink and just like, good job, Terrence. Like, you are selling like your fear, confusion, interest.
Yeah.
Like, look, good work.
My wife made a joke about that scene. Making jokes about a scene like that, but we were. And like, Terrence Howard in that moment looks like he came to set that day. They didn't give him a script. They didn't tell him what was going on. They just like thrust him into a scene. And he's like, just react. Like, let it be natural. And he's just like absolutely horrified.
I mean, now that you're saying it, like, I kind of...
That's why he's such a good actor. That's how he does every movie.
Just a little bit of obliviousness.
So come into this view and you were... you enjoyed it, obviously.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I still was like a little bit like, am I really going to get anything different out of watching this movie again? Uh-huh. Haven't I mastered this movie at this point?
No, you got to watch it for 10,000 hours.
Yeah, there was like still a lot of like really subtle stuff that I picked up on that I never really like, as much as I've like gone in on details of this movie, like one thing that jumped out was just like the threat of whistling. And how that kind of like keeps coming into play, not just like the whistle itself, but the actual idea of like whistling and song, or even like the song when Keller and his son are coming back from hunting at the beginning. It's like a gospel song,
mm-hmm.
and talking about like, you know, having faith and relying on God. And so much of the movie then is about religion and faith and the challenge of faith through this, through like tragedy and loss and pain.
Yeah, that was probably this viewing of the movie that what I felt the most was that theme. And I mean, obviously it's not like I didn't catch the theme before. It's a pretty overt theme. But just how much it, the idea of religion, spirituality, like if there is some sort of divine presence there, if you're all alone, just like purely just the existential crises that everyone in this movie seems to be facing stemming from religion. Like I felt that a lot more in this movie. And I mean, especially with Holly's character, Melissa Leo, just how, you know, she lost a son. Was it a son, right?
Yeah.
And then from that decided to quote in quotes wage a war with God. Like to think that the hurt and pain you feel, the unfairness of the world, these things that are inexplicable that happen to you that are tragic and terrible, like the fact that that could drive you to become somebody like this and to inflict that pain on other people and to cause them to go through the same emotions you went through and to question the idea of God. I mean, that's so, again, like that's so exaggerated and so movie-like, but to me that kind of captures the state of the world as I see it now. You know, half the reason like we have this sort of division in our country, in our world. It's just people hurt and they get mad when they hurt and they can't explain it. So they inflict hurt on other people and it becomes this very wide cyclical thing of hurt just kind of multiplying and causing people to go into other existential crises and like wonder like why the world is this way. It's this movie becomes like a microcosm of that.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara especially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Yeah, it's something that, like, that idea of, like, the timelessness of what it explores, not just, like, the abduction, like, getting way beyond, like, what actually happens, but getting into that crisis of faith and the way in which people either turn to infliction or maintain a course. Like, oh, but we do see Keller, like, take out his pain on Alex. Yeah. I mean, he's trying to get information, but still he's like inflicting pain on somebody else because he doesn't know what else to do. He can't just let Jake Gyllenhaal, Detective Loki, do the job.
Yeah.
Like, that's beyond him. But some of the stuff that like trips me up about this movie in like a great way in terms of what you're saying is just like, as bad as Keller is, him keeping Alex locked up is the thing that causes Holly to feel lonely, which is the reason why she keeps the kids alive.
Oh, wow.
So it's like,
did she ever say that?
Yeah, she says something about like she would have gotten rid of them earlier, but with Alex being gone.
Oh, wow.
So it's just one of those things where it's just like, playing into that idea of like, is it just coincidence? Is it all part of like this web of connections that add up into this idea of there being a divine presence? The fact that when Keller's praying when he's in the pits and he's like, dear God, like save my little girl, the very immediate next scene is Loki pulling up. Mm-hmm. And there's just like such connectivity there. But the larger thematics that you're saying about like how this ends up feeling like a microcosm in some ways for just like the way in which people deal with pain makes the movie feel like a bit timeless in a way, or like always applicable, whether people are aware of it or not. There's something like that resonates in that tension between like what Holly decides to do, how Keller's handling things, how Grace is handling things. Like, each person in this movie is handling their trauma in a different way, some productive, some like completely tragic. And that's very fascinating in terms of just a look at the human condition.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Liquid IV. When life gets busy, you grind, you push, you reach for a stick of Liquid IV powder. It hydrates you 2 times faster than water alone, so you can crush goals and your to-do list. Because real life is extreme enough. Real people, real flavor, real hydrating. Buy a stick in store or at liquidiv.com with the code podcast for 20% off your order.
It really explores that like kind of pinball effect that you see Again, this movie builds it up to such an insane level, but like the idea that, you know, Keller loses his kids, so his reaction is to kidnap someone else's kid. Like, that doesn't seem like the most sensible thing to do, but he's like so convinced that this person kidnapped his kids that he feels no remorse about taking someone else's child and keep them captive and doing all these terrible things to him. Only do we later find out that Alex isn't really Holly's son, that he was kidnapped and that he's been drugged and he's out of his mind. And so Alex then becomes this representation both on Holly's part and Keller's part of like just the trauma we inflict on children and just like how it manifests in them and carries over years and then pinballs and like affects these other people. And again, it's like the movie just ends up being a microcosm of like things you see out in the real world and how people deal with pain and hurt and the crazy, unreasonable reactions they have to all that.
Yeah, like I guess kind of like the two sides of the coin aspect to it. Like, not necessarily in Holly's case and what she's doing. There's no like other side of the coin. But I'm thinking about Keller specifically in his doomsday preparations. Like, that's a byproduct of his father's suicide.
Mm.
And because he lost his dad early, I think it specifically says the dad didn't even leave a note. Keller's kind of rocked by that and hasn't been able to get away from the impact of that on him, which is why that apartment building is still there after all these years, like unchanged, just kind of this haunting memory of where he grew up, the life he had with his like dad. And now that continues to affect him as this doomsday prepper, which he is then passing on to his kids to a degree. And the way that he's like raising them is in part inspired by this trauma. But at the same time, like him getting that red whistle for his daughter, which seems so over the top. It's that red whistle that's in the bottom of the pits. And it's exactly that red whistle that's going to be the thing that causes Loki to discover Keller like in this pits and save him. So it's just one of those little things where like that trauma has had such negative impact on him, but also there's another side to the coin of him being so prepared and him like taking these steps to kind of protect himself and try to protect his family.
Yeah, the whistle thing. So I guess as I'm saying this out loud now, I've realized what the answer is, but I'm gonna ask it anyway. Because in the moment I was confused, and then afterwards I was like, oh wait, that must be. So the girl, Hugh Jackman's daughter, she lost her whistle. Like, she even says something like, it's been gone for 113 days, which I really liked. That was like a, I always love when they do that kind of things of characters, like little, just little quirks like that. Like, I feel like that says so much about a person that she knows like the exact amount of days it's been gone. So I'm guessing, so when he goes down into the hole, he doesn't find her whistle because it's gone. He just, that whistle's just left over from another child who had been down there.
They specifically went off to try and find the whistle. So my thought on it was that she and Joy were able to find the whistle before they were taken.
Okay.
And that it was like that like whistle.
Wow, after 113 days, she finds it on the day she gets kidnapped. That's lucky.
That is lucky. I mean, it could be like just another whistle and there's like a coincidence to that, like it just kind of coming full circle. I guess it doesn't necessarily change things either way.
No, it doesn't. Like, I was just curious.
Yeah, but that is true that it would be like a huge coincidence in that.
That is everything we just talked about. Like, that's one of the things about this movie that I think does resonate with people. It isn't exactly something that gets me jazzed about a movie, but I mean, we're sitting here talking about the whistle, like we're going into the detail about like where the whistle came from. Like, there is something kind of fun about a movie like this that is just full of little nuances and hints and expositions like that, Larry. Like, you kind of have to, once the movie's done, you have to kind of look back and think through things and discuss them with people, and you're like, oh, that's why this happened, oh, and that led to that, and okay, now I get it. Like, people love that shit nowadays with like, you know, murder mysteries and everyday.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's become, I don't know when that started. I feel like there's probably just kind of like artsy movies back
Serial,
in the day.
That were... I feel like Serial was big around this time.
Oh, like specifically like in terms of like murder.
Just culturally, mysteries. Like people being fascinated with that stuff. Like, it started with Serial in terms of podcasts. It's now like much bigger in podcast form. But yeah, just in general, like people being obsessed with these stories and like wanting to know more about them, and like docuseries. Now there are a bunch of docuseries on Netflix, but I'm sure there were plenty of docuseries on TV back then.
Are you talking just like in general, specifically about like kidnapping, murder, like all the true crime stuff?
Just true crime stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I thought you were saying like people wanting to discuss just like the plots of movies.
No, people have always and will forever continue to do that.
Yeah, I was like, when did movies start getting like a little like more puzzle boxy?
I guess that would have been like where, 90s.
I feel like it would have taken on a bit more of that, right? Like, yeah.
You know, like kind Seven of, and Fight Club.
Yeah. Yeah, right?
Yeah, it was just like things that like need to be explained. Like, what's that? The 12 Monkeys, you know, just like a bunch of movies like that.
I feel like you probably had some of the surreal films back in the day, like Last Year at Marienbad, 2001 Space Odyssey.
And then like any David Lynch movie.
Yeah, kind of like getting into that arena, but it feels like it really became something where like each year you could kind of look for an October, November, like September, October, November film that was going to have a little bit of that convoluted aspect.
Yeah, for sure.
I think one of my favorite things, and it stood out to me the first time I watched it, and it's always like a part I look forward to every time I watch the movie, is the close-up of the tree. When the girls are getting kidnapped, it's just like,
oh yeah,
the family's still like having a happy Thanksgiving day, like Terrence Howard's playing the trumpets, and you just go to like the tree and the shot just closing in on the tree, and it's inexplicable in the moment, and then the very next like shot is Keller coming down to the kids being like, have you seen your sisters?
Well, so why do you like that shot so much? Because I noted that shot myself, in the sense that it was a very ugly shot.
It's just so menacing. Like, I've never felt intimidated by a tree, and I felt incredibly intimidated by a tree with how it kind of like zoomed in. There was just something like dreadful about that moment when like we just heard a family like singing songs, like it should be nice, but something about like the weather, the focus on the tree, and the fact that I think that there's something like unspoken about it. Like the subtext of the shot is that during this time, this is when the girls got kidnapped, and that's not really apparent on the first watch, but as you're watching through, it's almost like instead of focusing on the kidnapping, they just decide to show us this tree for a few seconds. But it kind of builds up this air of like tension in a way that's not like indirect to the actual action that's taking place at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like we're now getting into the territory of like, all right, spoiler alert, a spoiler halfway through the episode. I didn't enjoy this movie this time either. Like I've just never enjoyed watching this movie.
Son of a bitch.
And this scene that you're talking about, it's so funny that like, you're describing the scene with such life, and I don't necessarily deny any of the stuff that you just said. Like, I think all of that is applicable to that shot on paper. But I feel nothing during that shot, and it feels like ugly, I guess. Like, I use the word ugly, and that's honestly the word I would use to describe this movie in general. Like, I constantly don't feel anything, despite like, I gotta tell you, ever since I had a kid, like any time a movie is about like father daughter or like anything involving a family, like everything everywhere all at once, like I usually end up like having an extreme reaction to the movie. This movie, I really don't feel anything the whole time I'm watching it. Like obviously very good actors. Obviously like on paper, a very riveting story, but like the way it's presented with that tree moment being kind of the case in point, like I just like nothing is ever really grabbing me about this movie and pulling me into what is a very fantastic situation, and that's kind of a deal breaker for me when it comes to movies. Like I need to be emotionally invested, I need to be gripped, I need to be moved, and it's just something about the presentation of this movie. And I think about Denis movies in general, like, I kind of always feel that way. Like, the only movie I can think of from him that I didn't feel that way was Polytechnique, which a movie I felt intensely. And to me, that movie has a much different rhythm, energy. Like, you're very consumed by these people who are caught up in the shooting and the way it's navigating everything. Like, I don't know what happened with, like, his presentation and how he explored these subjects, but, like, a movie like Prisoners, while I can agree that it's good on paper and there's a lot of fascinating stuff about it, like it's just a personal subjective thing. Like I can't find my in with it.
It's so crazy to me.
I mean, you just described a tree. Like I don't know how. Like I don't know how I could possibly read into a shot of a tree like that.
Yeah, I don't know how you can't. It is like a darker color palette in terms of just like the cinematography, which, I mean, you might just not like Pennsylvania. Maybe we should just put all the blame on Pennsylvania.
I don't mind that look. That's like a David Fincher look. I like that.
Yeah. I'd like to just like sit down and watch like a scene and be like, why isn't this working?
it's purely stylistic. Like, it's like any painting. Like a painting has to bring whatever it's looking at to life. Like it needs to thrust me into that world and make me see like the rhythms, the movement, the thematically what it's exploring, the emotion I'm getting from it. Like everything in this movie, like I just feel like if another person made this exact movie, same script, same actors, and there was just a different cinematographer and a different person in the director's chair, like kind of guiding and navigating everything, like this would come to life. Like I would feel it viscerally. But there's just something so static and blah about it all. I mean, that's terrible of me to say. Like, I know nothing about making a movie and how to make that stuff work, but like I do see it work quite often from directors I like. And for some reason, Villeneuve. I can't even say his name right. Like, I shouldn't be insulting him, but like it's consistently the problem I run into with these movies.
I'm at a loss for words because it's explosive to me in a way that like I find so many other films like kind of hollow, not as interesting, like a little like I find the emotion in this throughout, like to me it's almost like perfectly executed start to finish. Like I think it's one of the most like approaching perfect movies that I've ever watched.
Well, people seem to be on your side on that one. I'm the oddball.
Right. But just like, you know, with that shot with the tree, like trees, the landscape, like it ends up being like a repeating like visual motif throughout the film. Mm-hmm. And there was something, I don't know if I included it in the first guide or if it was like an update later, but something about the idea with like Loki and his connection with like Norse mythology and the way that Norse mythology was very connected to like the woods mm-hmm. and the land, specifically trees. There's just something very fascinating to me in that, like both the contrast, but also like the unity of the like Christian faith and the more, what is it when something's non-Christian?
Like, not pagan. That's not what that is. I don't know.
Blanking on the word, but yeah, a little more pagan, like Norse mythology, I think was a bit more pagan in that way. And like the tension between those two things is they're usually at like odds with each other, but also the way that you can kind of see the way like faith and religion is kind of entwining, and it might be bigger than like the way in which Keller understands it or the way in which Loki understands it.
Right.
Like, so like that one shot of the tree for me connects with like all this other like visual, all the other visual right. choices that are being made with the movie.
So let's back up to the Norse thing. Do they talk about that in the movie?
No, there's nothing like ever outright about it. It's just Loki's name being Loki. Mm-hmm. And then initially talking about the Zodiac, the tattoos that he has are tattoos of like other faiths. Mm-hmm. So you have like Keller, who's very like clearly like Christian. Or Catholic,
right?
Heavily on that end, and then Loki, from his name to his tattoos to like his opening scene, seems very much positioned as like the other.
I definitely don't want to shit on any of that because that's all fascinating, and that's interesting to me that. Basically what I'm saying is I don't want to shit on people who find that fascinating. Like if that's...
It just doesn't do anything for you emotionally.
Like, I really don't have any interest in a movie that's going through those kinds of rhythms that, like, you need to know stuff outside of the movie and, like, research and bring it back. Like, that makes me sound like a simpleton or something, but, like, I guess. And I do. So the way I'm going to paint this is, like, you discussing all that, like, that is interesting to me, and I like knowing that now. And maybe that will color my impression of the movie, like, if I watch it for the fourth time. But I, still, even knowing that information, like, it doesn't really matter to me if it's not part of the movie, if it's not expressed visually or at least through a little bit of dialogue. Like if I'm not let in on that and if it's not part of the movie's makeup and emotion, like, it's just very difficult for me to, like, even I, after hearing all that from you, like, I'm not going to feel moved by it within the movie because it's not part of the movie. Like, it's not part of the art. Like, does that make sense? Like, I just, like, there's something in myself that is not able to do that.
Part of that makes sense because it is part of the art. Like, there's, like, subtextual stuff throughout, or just, like, show, don't tell stuff throughout that reinforces those ideas of, like, religion and Catholicism and, like,
for sure,
other religious views, that it's, like, it's infused into the movie from, like, shots to dialogue to just, like, the editing, like, talking about when Keller prays to then cutting right to Loki arriving and this, like, infusion that Loki has over the course of the movie of kind of being this, like, not God figure, but almost, like, divine figure.
Mm-hmm.
Is really, like, fascinating. Is not something that's just, like, kind of, like, skipped over or not developed. Like, it's very much, like, part of the DNA of the film. But I do get what you're saying in terms of it not being as, like, pronounced in a way that lets you in on that as, like, a primary, like, part of the viewing experience, where it feels like that's having, like, a much more active part in the film than what it has. Because I think whenever something's, like, subtextual like that, it tends to take on a passive feeling throughout the course of the movie. Even if it creates, like, a sense of tension in the movie, there's still something where, like, it's a bit more passive and asking you to dive in a bit more to discover, like, the oil that's beneath the surface kind of thing. And there's a way of handling that that's, like, a middle ground that makes it, like, subtextual but expressive and active in the film.
Yes.
And then there's the way of just making it, like, purely active in the film, which, like, you are, I think
that's what I want.
Yeah, you tend to lean more
I want it
towards
to feel
that.
Alive.
Yeah, with, like, loving Michael Bay movies the way that you love Michael Bay movies. Absolutely. Like, loving the Fast and Furious franchise the way you love the Fast and Furious franchise.
Yeah, but those movies are frenetic. Like, even a movie like After Sun, which I don't know if you've seen After Sun.
Not yet.
I mean, it's this father's depression is kind of, it's felt throughout the movie. It's subtle at first, but then it kind of builds and you see more and it becomes, like, part of, like, the pulsating beat of the movie. Like, in a way that I just don't see in a movie like Prisoners. Like, I see it all technically. Like, I can look at your article and, like, yeah, that motif is there. Like, this happened. Like, this person said that. But it feels like a movie that I have to understand in retrospect. Like, I have to sit down, like, think about it, like, okay, that makes sense, instead of a movie that actively, as I'm watching it, like, I'm overwhelmed by it.
Yeah. I mean, I have it's hard for me to comment on After Sun having not seeing it. My impression based on just, like, what I've read and heard of it is that the movie being, like, a little more focused on, like, the father's experience allows that to have, like, more of an active role, where, like, Prisoners is a little more spread out across its, like, kaleidoscope of characters.
Yeah. You're right. So then that way they're not really that similar.
But there's that. I think that's a good example of, like, the middle ground of things, or even something like Apocalypse Now, I think, is, like, a middle ground between, like, the like outwardness of a Michael Bay movie versus like the insane subtlety of
right
Prisoners in that way, where you have something like Apocalypse Now where it's very firmly one of those things where you have like the subtle stuff and the subtextual stuff, but like it makes it clear how active those things are, whether it's through like moments of dialogue or just giving like a scene that speaks a lot more clearly to it. I think Villeneuve, especially with like Enemy in that same year, was very much in his bag when it came to like, I want to be as like subtextual as possible right now.
Yeah. So if you're not like me, you know, you're not some curmudgeon and you can enjoy movies on the level Chris does, I do think this movie is pretty fascinating in that way, that like there are so many subtleties in quotes, like things you have to like catch in the moment or like you missed it, or things that you think don't matter that like matter later. And because of that, my wife and I did talk about this movie for a bit. We went on a walk after we watched it. And we did have some questions. And Chris, I want to run them by you to get your take.
Yeah, please.
Okay. So when, who's the creepy guy who's touching the bunny at the, yeah.
Yeah.
Toby?
Oh my God. Bob Taylor.
Bob Taylor. Toby. Toby. His name should have been Toby. That's just my radical pitch. So they search his place and he's got like mazes all over the wall and stuff. And they find a book about this famous serial killer who's obsessive mazes. I don't remember exactly what they said about this character. Is
the Invisible Man.
Okay. Yeah. So is the Invisible Man, is that Holly's husband?
Yeah. Holly, I guess it would be not just Holly's husband, but Holly and her husband.
Oh, okay.
It seems like it was kind of the two of them working together.
Got it.
They did say that the area had 9 like sex offenders.
Mm.
So I think, I mean, Holly says that they like took a lot of kids, but I don't know if like all 16, I think they say at one point, were like her and her husband, or if it was like 13 of them were her and her husband, or like 10. But yeah, they took a lot of kids. But that would have been them.
Okay. We found that a little confusing because like if they... like they must know, I guess in the police officer's mind, like they think somebody is mimicking the Invisible Man, and like that's whoever is mimicking the Invisible Man took these children. It just struck us as bizarre that they didn't think this book was right if this was suddenly happening again, you know?
I guess some of the details there would be the book was written sometime before.
Yeah.
And the cop says that it was disproven.
Yeah.
But that's kind of like one of those things you throw into the dialogue, but it's like, yeah. How was it disproven? Why was it disproven? In the newspaper article that Loki's reading about, what's Alex's original name? Like Barry? Barry's disappearance, it mentions that like some think that it might be part of like, serial child kidnapper, and the FBI are working with the family to figure it out. So it makes it seem like there's at least been people were talking about it. How long has it been? Like 15 years, 12 years, 20 years, something.
Yeah. Right.
In that realm. And then Holly's husband's been missing for 5 years. And the amount of kidnapping slowed down at that point. But it does seem strange that like you have a town that's had, it seems like a small town, and that there have been over a dozen like child abductions in like a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And here you have 2 more kids that are abducted. Like, you think people would be talking a bit more about
exactly
that.
I think that's what we found a little confusing, and like how much importance to assign to that book, and like they're kind of just brushing away the book. And I was like, oh, so it was like Holly not connected to the book? So it was just a little confusing.
Yeah, it seems that her husband was like obsessed with the idea of the maze for whatever like reason he had, and that was something that they made all the kids do, was like get in the maze, so to speak, which was like the hole in the ground, do the maze puzzles. But Bob eventually ran away after 3 weeks, but it seems like he spent the rest of his life kind of obsessing.
Man, those 3 weeks really fucked him up.
Yeah. I mean, they mentioned that it's like a cocktail of LSD and ketamine. So I wonder how much, like, how like drugged up the kids are, like how sleep deprived, like the mazes, like the psychological trauma.
Yeah, man. I mean, this is not a detriment against the movie. Movies can explore any topic they want in any way they want, but like, I have a hard time watching movies where kids are just getting like drugged and abused like that. That is, I mean, again, that little girl though, Keller's daughter, like, she really just does a great job, as much as I can credit like a little kid at acting. Like, to play that part, that's intense. And like, her energy at the end of the movie, like, I thought it was palpable.
Yeah, they like
when she like rolls into the Loki's room on the wheelchair,
right? There was something really like, she sold that very well, to the point like there's times where when it's not like Hugh Jackman and Jake Gyllenhaal, which I know the other like actors are big deals too, like Maria Bello, Viola Davis,
Melissa,
like,
Leo's an Oscar winner.
Yeah, but there's something with like the kids, we're watching them, I'm sometimes forget that it's a movie. I'm just like, oh yeah, she's also an actor, like,
yeah,
acting, not just like an actual little child that's recovering. Like,
gosh,
really did sell that well.
That is terrible to think about, that like the drugs messed up Bob Taylor so bad. Like, what is she gonna be like? What is the rest of her life?
Yeah, that's kind of like some of the like sad implications about this, is that we want to you have hope that they'll be okay. I mean, it's just like 6 days rather than a couple weeks. But at the same time, like, the movie's called Prisoners and is exploring this trauma that all of these people have from various experiences. Like, is this going to be a trauma that they just like live with, or is it going to be a trauma that shapes them?
They're imprisoned by their trauma.
Yeah. Other questions?
So this was one I hadn't really thought about, because I thought there was an answer to it, but it seems people are curious about it from your article. So do you think Alex is the one that kidnapped the kids?
Yes.
Okay.
I think they got in the van with Alex. It says that he just wanted to play with them. Like, Holly tells Keller, like, he just wanted to play with them. I was the one that said they were gonna stay. Like, he was just driving around, so I imagine he drove around with them and then eventually drove back to like Holly's place. And okay. Holly like came out when he got back, saw the girls in the van, and were like, get in the hole.
Okay. I thought, I could be wrong about this, but I thought there was a moment when Hugh Jackman confronts Holly at the end of the movie and she pulls the gun on him, she said something about being in the van with Alex.
I'm pretty sure she just said that he just wanted to play with them, but she was the one. Because I can't imagine that she would, like, I can't imagine he would go back to his, like, former home with her in the car.
Right. That's true. That's a good point.
Like, I feel like that's something that, like, he does on his own as kind of, like, longing for what he used to have. But there is, like, a line of dialogue where she acknowledges, like, the kids being in the van.
Okay. That does make it make a little more sense. And it definitely tracks a little bit more that, like, these kids would get into the van with, like, another kid. Like, he's a little older than them, but, like, he's not, like, some crazy old woman. So like,
right.
It makes sense that he's able to, and then he brings him back there and he doesn't think anything's going to happen, and Melissa Leo takes him. So that checks out. Oh, here's a question, and I don't know how you feel about this. Do you think mazes are a relevant motif in this movie?
Oh, whoa.
I wasn't sure if they were or not, so I wanted to get your expert opinion.
It would have been nice if you had told me this during prep.
Yeah, sorry.
That way I could prepare for this question,
but I wanted your honest, like, reactionary response. So
I'm gonna go out on a limb and say no.
I agree, so we can move on.
One thing that, like, I feel like the first couple times I watched the movie, I wondered what he meant when Alex is in his personal sauna.
I don't remember this.
And just when he's like in the hot box in the shower that kind of keeps turning.
I thought it was a line of dialogue. I was like, man, that is a bizarre line. Like, I do not remember that.
He mentions that he, whatchamacallit, he's not Alex. He's like, I'm not Alex.
Yeah.
I just wanted to play. He never showed up. You know, he just never came. I just wanted to play, that kind of thing. I saw people speculate that maybe that meant that Alex was waiting for somebody. That's why he was at the parking lot at the gas station. Like, maybe Bob Taylor ran away. Oh. I think maybe I was I actually mentioned that in the initial article that I wrote. Like, maybe he's talking about Bob running away. But watching it this time, it seemed very clear what he was indicating was that, I'm guessing Holly and her husband, their son's name was Alex, and that's the kid who died from cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And that when they kidnapped Barry, they said, do you want to play with our son Alex? And he's like, yeah, sure. And they like picked him up in the van and brought him home, and he's like, where's Alex? And they're like, you're in a maze now, you're Alex. And just made him become Alex.
Yeah, I completely agree. That's what I got from it.
Yep.
This is something else you mentioned in your article. Like, why didn't Alex confess to the police or Keller? Like, it is interesting that, like, Alex says that thing to Keller, that, like, they didn't cry until I left them. Like, why would he be telling Keller things and not the police?
It seems to be one of those things where he's kind of, I would say, imprisoned by his experience, or maybe even like takes a little bit of joy from causing the pain.
Yeah.
So he doesn't want to get in trouble. So he knows what he's doing by like lying. He's playing dumb. But we see it in the way that he's so casually cruel to the dog when he yanks the dog up and just holds it there by the collar. Like, hanging in the air, that he wants to inflict pain. It's something that you hear the phrase like hurt people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that we kind of see and talked about already as a theme in this movie, the same way that Holly and her husband lose a kid, so they start taking other people's kids to cause them the same pain. So it seems like Alex in a way knew what he was doing, and just in that moment where Keller's so upset, he wants to just like inflict that little bit more of pain. And there's also, we see clearly that he's like struggling to express what happened to him. It seems he's like suffering from Stockholm syndrome in an incredible way. Like, he could drive away at any time. He doesn't have to go back to Holly's house at this point, but he does willingly every single day. So part of like Barry is really has become Alex in this way, and is so like psychologically messed up that it's something that he probably struggles to even figure out how to talk about or discuss or untangle. So that's his own like personal maze. But the reason why he like says these things to Keller, maybe doesn't even talk a lot of it, is that he wants to cause pain.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of thinking, is he's caught in this weird in-between where he's been completely reshaped by Holly and her husband and turned into this sort of monster who is complicit and like on the same terms as them. It's like kidnapping children and inflicting pain in the world. They're like weird wage of war with God mission. That he's just like Stockholm system. He's been in it for so long that like he's just adopted it, but also on the other side, like internally, he is a child who was kidnapped. Like, he feels pain, he feels for these girls, and probably ultimately feels for Keller. So like, we just see this deviation between like him feeling sympathy and like wanting his life back, and just like what he's stuck in and how Holly has turned him into this sort of monster.
Yeah, it's bleak. I found the dialogue that she has. She says, you should know Alex didn't lay a hand on the girls, just wanted to give them a ride in the RV. I was the one who decided they should stay.
Oh, that must have been the line where I thought she was talking about being in the van.
Yeah, it's ambiguous enough to where you could read it as like, I was in the van. I also thought that they should
Yeah.
I was fine with it, but then I was like, you know what? They should stay. But it's also ambiguous enough to the point of like, you know, he brought them back to his place. It was just like, I just gave them a ride. And she's like, no, you know what? They should stay.
Yeah. Okay. Good to get clarification on that. I would say that's all the main questions we had. Is there anything else that gets you jazzed about this movie, Chris, you want to talk about?
I think one thing of notes, I mean, maybe people have read the article, maybe they know this, have looked it up themselves, but in the original script, it did have a scene where like Loki finds Keller. And it was in the script up until when they were filming. And then at the point where they were filming, Denis was just like, we don't, it's obvious. Like, we don't need to film this. We don't need to do that. Just like, he hears the whistle and you can like put it together that he's going to find her. I mean, him not finding her leaves that room of like degree of ambiguity. But there's so many other parts in the movie where we see Loki kind of like follow up on little clues or details that it would just be such a betrayal of the established character for him just to be like, nah, and leave.
That's all. I definitely agree. That is the right choice to not show Loki finding Keller. A, for what you just said, like it's just part of his character. Like, of course he would go open up and find him. But I will say it's interesting that Denis, and maybe there are deeper reasons for doing what he did, but it seems the reason he did what he did is because it's just implied that Loki will go over and get him and that we don't need to show it. Where for me, it was kind of one of the few moments in the movie, like I actually felt something. and it was like, by not showing Loki going over to Keller, it was the symbolic way of showing Keller being imprisoned. Like whether or not Loki goes to get him, it's this call for help. The fact that he is trapped, there's this kind of, there's not ambiguity about whether or not Loki will get him. There's ambiguity about like whether or not he'll remain a prisoner, whether or not this experience has like forever changed him, if he'll ever come back and be the man he was and be a better father and all that.
Yeah. I mean, we don't know if he's going to go to prison for what he did to Alex. Yeah. We don't know if he will be able to stop drinking again, because he used drinking as like a cover when Loki was following him, but then he continued to drink.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen there? He already had his doomsday complex. Is he going to go further down that rabbit hole of having this untreated grief that has already stricken him and been affecting his life? Like, how much crazier is he going to be? Like, is he going to put both of his kids on leashes?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I say good call on that one.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a was the smarter move.
Man.
But I kind of hoped that this time it would be like the big breakthrough, but alas.
Even someone like Jake Gyllenhaal, I think it's like incredible actor, and he has such energy in this movie. Like, I feel like the movie does a disservice to him. Like, I feel like I could have felt his performance a lot more. That's just like, I don't know. It's kind of like a vague complaint about this movie that like stylistically it's not presenting everything viscerally enough for me, but that's really the only way I can put it.
Yeah, I can see it's a little more. Did you like, I can't remember. Do you like Zodiac or do you not like Zodiac?
I remembered liking Zodiac, and the second time I watched it, I thought it was just okay, but I'm still a fan of that movie.
Okay. I feel like this and Zodiac are like very similar in their presentation, and cinematography and energy, though maybe that gives the main character a little bit more of like a journey.
Mm-hmm. Right. I know what you mean, but I would say just naturally whatever David Fincher's doing, like I think his pacing's a little more to my liking. He's a little more intense, I think.
Yeah, there's a... Fincher is very... But he doesn't have an intense close-up on a single tree.
That's true, so that kind of lost me, I will admit.
Do you have like a favorite moment in the movie?
That's a good question. Do you have a favorite moment that you haven't expressed?
I think I really love the character introductions, like the Thanksgiving Day.
Yeah,
I was thinking contrast about that. Between like the Kellers and Dovers and the time that they're spending together and how like warm and bright it is. And then when they have to call the cops, them going to like call the cops, and then it cuts to just like the cop car in the parking lot. It's rainy, it's dark, it's Jake Gyllenhaal alone in this Chinese restaurant trying to like strike up conversation
and I did
the
like
Zodiac dialogue. Yeah, there's just something very like awesome to me about the flow of that.
Yeah, I do like that part. I think, yeah, I'm thinking about it now. I think the end is my favorite part, which again is kind of a bummer to hear Denis say the only reason he did it was like purely for plot. To me, I just feel like there's so much thematic and character implications there that it felt like a moment that like the movie felt enlivened to me, and that it was expressing a core idea visually and by something that didn't need to be spoken, you know?
I have enough faith in Denis that I'm sure he also agrees with you that it wasn't just plot, but it was the right call for like all the themes.
I know. I have to think like I there's no way he didn't do that on purpose, like for thematic reasons, but still I'm just reacting to what he actually said, like what you read. That's so funny to me. Like that's how he put it.
Oh, it was like the screenplay writer.
Oh, okay. Just the screenplay writer. Okay, then
yeah,
that's different.
Yeah, relaying like kind of secondhand some of the like thought process of it.
All right, fair enough. Denis, you win that one.
Denis wins. There we go. There we go.
I mean, he's great. I don't want to... I'm sounding like I'm shitting on him. I mean, I don't like very many of his movies, but like he's struck a chord. Like he's huge. Dune's fucking huge. Like dude's just on a... Here's the one thing I'll say about him. And while I don't really care for the way he presents his actors, like he gets incredible actors in his movies and like they're acting their asses off. So kudos.
Yeah. I think you feel about Denis the way that I feel about like Nolan at this point.
Yeah.
Like I recognize why people really are attracted to what Nolan does, but it just doesn't work on me for me anymore.
Yeah. A lot of the times it doesn't with Nolan, but I will say I really enjoy Inception and Tenet. So all the other ones, I don't know.
Inception and I have to rewatch The Prestige. I liked it back in the day. Batman Begins. That's it.
I do like moments of Batman Begins, but only because it's so fucking insane that I'm just like, wow, like how did they make this movie?
Yeah. He really went places with it.
Yeah, there's just some bold choices in that one. And then it got boring. Like Dark Knight Returns is so boring compared to that movie.
I just feel like he was at the point where like he was really excited about Batman Begins. He put all his time and effort into The Dark Knight and like it got lauded and acclaimed in the way that he was like, see? And then they're like, you have to do a third. And he's just like,
I want to make Inception.
Yeah, like I want to do so many other things that aren't this dumb movie. And so he just made a lot of frustrating choices.
Okay, so we did it, Chris. We talked about your favorite movie ever.
One of them. I don't even know if it's in my top 10.
It's in your top 10 of most viewed movies.
I don't know if it's even in that.
Yeah. I'm trying to... That idea of you watching the movie like twice within a week, like there are a few movies I have like that those always just end up being a special one, I think, no matter what. Like I watched Picnic at Hanging Rock, like, almost back-to-back, and I've watched it since then, and even though it doesn't hit quite like it did the first time, like, there's something special about that movie based on, like, the first experience I had with it and, like, how entranced I was by it, that I watched it multiple times in a short period of time that you can't really shake.
Yeah, it just kind of, like, stays with you.
Yeah.
Babadook was one.
Oh yeah, Babadook.
That did that.
You did a Tropical Malady, right?
Tropical Malady. Yeah.
That should be a requirement of that movie. You should have to watch it twice in a row.
Just to be like, what the what in the world? See, that's a movie that does such a great job of like subtlety and subtext.
Yeah.
But still having this like very active energy throughout.
Yeah, you're wrapped up in it.
Oh, what a movie.
Mm. Someday we'll talk about it.
Yeah. Could you imagine we do like a podcast episode on Prisoners, it gets 20,000 plays, and then we do Tropical Malady and it's like seven.
We'll have to wait for Criterion to put out the Blu-ray, because like I don't know how much longer society can continue, how much further civilization can make it before Tropical Malady gets released on Blu-ray. Like, somebody has to have the balls to do this.
I thought they had a Blu-ray come out just from one of the weird, no, I shouldn't say weird, one of the smaller like places.
As far as I know, there's just a DVD.
Ah, that's a shame. That needs to happen. I thought it would have happened. Oh, wait, what is this? Tropical Malady is getting a 4K restoration.
No. Where are you reading this?
This is from 1 year ago on Boutique Blu-ray, the subreddit.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure.
They said, I just attended a workshop. This is posted by Do Sample. A workshop supporting the premiere of Memoria in his home country, Thailand, today. I had a chance to chat with him a little bit about whether his 2004 masterpiece Tropical Malady would receive a long overdue restoration. And the good news is, yes, a 4K restoration is currently in the works and will be done by the end of this year. This means it should be released on Blu-ray by different distributors around the world next year.
All right. So if we believe Reddit user DoSample36291, like if his scoop on this is true and he's not making it up, we'll see a Blu-ray of it by the end of the year.
Though hopefully it's like a worldwide release.
Yeah, it needs to come back to theaters. Like, I'll be there in a second.
Oh my God. If they got to play that, I'm just going to email the Alamo Drafthouse every single day. Like, play Tropical Malady in theater, you cowards.
You cowards.
Just going to, like, you cowards at the end of every email. That has to, like, dig at them, right?
Yeah, I think that'll do something.
Has to.
Mm.
Tried and true tactic.
Okay, what do people need to do? They need to go visit filmcolossus.com.
Should do that.
Go read Chris's piece.
They should subscribe. We're telling people to subscribe to the podcast at the end of the podcast.
Well, I'll put in something at the beginning. How about that?
Smart. Okay. So if you have listened this whole time and you didn't subscribe at the beginning, subscribe now.
Yeah. And if you want to support us, you can become a patron. We have a Patreon account, patreon.com/filmcolossus. Right now, for $3 a month, you can listen to the episodes ad-free. We'll be adding more perks in the future, but for now, you get that sweet, sweet perk.
What a perk.
Wow. And that's it. Do we know what movie we're covering next?
Do we?
We could talk about Perfect Blue.
We should. It would be nice to talk about a movie that you're excited to talk about.
Okay, let's talk about Perfect Blue.
Okay.
Or Black Swan. You won't know. This is a tease. We're either going to talk about Black Swan or Perfect Blue.
All right.
Oof. I don't know. People are going to just be dripping with anticipation. I don't think they're going to be able to handle it.
Somebody should make the joke, aren't they the same movie?
I didn't even think about that. Maybe we'll talk about both of the movies at the same time. Like, you'll talk about Black Swan and I'll talk about Perfect Blue. And we'll just have overlapping dialogue.
Perfect.
Okay. So Blue. Expect that.
Wonderful.
All right. Bye.
See ya. Got a big question to ask. Anything? Do you want to do anything?
We'd all love to hit skip on our problems now and again, but using weed to deal with stress as a teen won't make your issues go away. Learn more at mindovermarijuana.com. That's mindovermarijuana.com.
Sponsored by the California Department of Public Health.